Welcome to the Roanoke Collaboration Radio Show, where we discuss Radio IQ news stories on Radio Melrose.
You can't get blood from a turnip, right?
That's Ashley Green with the Western Tidewater Free Clinic in Suffolk. She's been in the business of serving some of Virginia's most needy for 12 years, and she said costs, from staff to medication and everything in between, have skyrocketed.
Anyone running a household to a business knows things just cost more. What we're all facing with the current landscape and what's coming our way is the need to do more and less money to do it with.
That warning comes before changes in President Donald Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill kick in. It's expected to see hundreds of thousands of Virginians lose health care, driving more patients to free clinics like the ones Green runs or to emergency rooms at a higher cost. Rufus Phillips is CEO of the Virginia Association of Free and Charitable Clinics, the group that advocates for free clinics at the legislature. He said their network usually gets about $8 million a year from the state, but they need more, $15 million more, to meet the coming demand. But current estimates now put the funding closer to $5 million. Phillips said that's not enough.
That added demand is going to really stress the healthcare system in Virginia, and free clinics are on the front line, Brad, when it comes to trying to take care of the uninsured. Things may be challenging now for the free clinics, but they're going to be a lot more challenging over these next few years.
Budget negotiations are ongoing with a late April target for a final deal. Whether or not clinics get the funding they say they need remains to be seen. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Okay. I'm Dana Ackley, author of the forthcoming book, Emotional Intelligence for a Divided World.
I'm Jay Foster with the Praxis Way.
William Fralin, former member of the Virginia House of Delegates.
David Points, retired educator and military.
Cynthia Lawrence, director of workforce development at Carilion Clinic.
Catherine Elam, former director of Junior Achievement of Southwest Virginia.
Joyce Waugh, president and CEO of the Roanoke Regional Chamber, retired.
Wayne Strickland, former executive director of the Roanoke Valley Allegheny Regional Commission.
Michael Brockta, CIA retired and recent president of the Kiwanis Club of Roanoke.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for joining us today. And we've got nine people to delve into this story. Any initial thoughts on, turns out there's not enough money to do everything we want to do. Is that unusual?
It's not unusual.
Thank you, Joyce. I appreciate you agreeing with me. You know, the free clinics offer a significant backbone to the healthcare sort of continuum, I suspect. One of the things I thought that struck me, and I'll just sort of kick us off here, I thought the Affordable Care Act was going to fix all this. In other words, I thought we were going to have more people covered, that we weren't going to have as big a gap. In fact, the free clinics were going to be more compensated with Medicaid if they take Medicaid. I assume they do. But it turns out that there's still not enough money.
Don't you think that part of that is because cost, regardless of, you know, current bills or former bills, costs tend to rise. And so even if everything stays the same, you know, those costs are going to rise. And then you have, you know, people, you know, like Cynthia, are really closer to that than I am on the knowledge side. But I think that point about frontline, being on the front line for free clinics, is absolutely true. And without a doubt, that someone getting assistance, medical treatment or medicines or whatever there, has to be a much greatly reduced cost than going to the emergency room.
Well, I will say this, being in business, it's tangentially related to healthcare costs. And Cynthia, we're coming to you in a minute, so get ready. But medical inflation is different from average inflation. Medical inflation is triggered by prescription drug costs, labor costs. There are a lot of different things that go into, and it usually outpaces regular inflation. So when regular inflation is up, you can probably add another couple percentage points to medical inflation. So and what I heard from the story was they were used to getting $8 million for all the free clinics in Virginia, which seems like not a lot of money, and it's going to be cut to five. And so that was the concern, and they would like it to be 15, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, the free and charitable clinics are staffed by volunteers and from the medical community. And they have full-time staff, of course, that are employees. But many of the medical providers are volunteers. And in our region, we are fortunate enough to have the Virginia Tech Carilion School of Medicine. And we've got Delta Dental that brings in dental students from other programs. So we have care providers that are able to do some of that frontline screening and some of the triaging that has to occur. But when you get into the complexities of other healthcare needs, then more specialty care is required. And that comes at a higher cost. And so it is, of course, in the best interest of all hospital systems and physician practices to support the free and charitable clinics, but there's also a role for philanthropy and employer engagement here as well, because it, by nature, they started as free and charitable clinics, and that is still their financial structure today. So support from the state is relatively a recent development in their infrastructure.
So Cynthia, just to, and you, Bill Lee, who's our New Horizons representative, is not here today. So can you just sort of tell our listeners a little bit about New Horizons, what you know about how it operates?
Well, New Horizons is a federally qualified health center. So they do take insurance. Right. They do have care providers. They do have employees. It is financially structured through federal dollars, and it is different in financial structure than a free and charitable clinic. So the clinic in our area is the Bradley Free Clinic over on 3rd Street. And there are many volunteer care providers that are there during the daytime and evening hours. And the services range from mental health services all the way through primary care and everything in between, including a pharmacy.
Do I correctly understand that the free clinic and such can serve the primary care, but once, when you talked about specialty care, once it gets complicated, then it's a different situation. Is that correct?
That would be the premise, yes. So they're going to triage the most critical healthcare needs. They will then work with other providers to deliver if there's cancer treatment that's required, for example. But the Bradley Free Clinic does have a very extensive mental health staff and a mental health practice, and so they are able to deliver that as well as addiction counseling and everything that goes along with that particular line of service. They also have needs for multilingual care providers. And so there is a complexity there in identifying and recruiting and retaining the volunteers that they need to stay staffed so that they can meet the needs of the clients.
You know, when I was listening to Cynthia and Dana, you know, Dana, you're a mental health professional, and it strikes me that a free clinic treating mental health issues in that context may be difficult, because I think a lot of mental health treatment requires follow-ups, continual relationship building, things like that. It's not like you got a cold and you go in, you need to get treatment and maybe have one follow-up visit. It's a continual thing, right?
It is. It is. And there's a concierge approach to that somewhat, because all of the care providers are connected professionally with each other. And so in the case of someone that might seek help at the Bradley, they would have a trusted provider there who could, if needed, work with a specialty provider outside of the Bradley to give that client the care they need.
Sometimes when I hear the word free in particular communities, it means that I don't have to pay anything or there may not be any value. Sometimes when we talk about funding statewide, federal, and we say free funding, it relates to poor people. But if we have comments or support mechanisms where we can communicate with those individuals saying, yes, this is a service that's provided because of volunteers, it has more value. I'm just thinking of the people that we in this audience, some of the people in this audience of Radio Melrose in the city of Melrose, that mindset of free, everything is free. Free books, free this, free that. But we need more explanation to understand the value of healthcare and the price. That needs clarity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Catherine.
Well, another thing I'm wondering, when we talk about triage, we certainly have, I know there's a new model that's in the Fallon Park schools. And I'm thinking this is a way that our children sometimes are seen in these new clinic settings. It's on the school grounds. There's different things that are going on there. I'm not sure how it's funded and what that model looks like, but I do know that it's one of those things that people are looking at trying to replicate in another part of the city. But it's because of the number of children that are enrolled in that school, they decided it was necessary because of the pedestrian count in that area. Also promoted the idea that they would open a facility where they would have someone there. Mm-hmm. It also goes back to, again, to the Melrose Plaza area. There is a section there that we've learned a little bit that is taking the time to help those residents come in. There will be certain days of the week where there'll be somebody from the health profession in that space. I think it is partially funded with Carillion and others that are helping to provide that space there for the neighborhood, and that they can go in and actually learn a little bit more. I think some of the first services provided were for those who are on the WIC program, and then others were going in to have the blood work checked and hypertension, that type of thing being addressed there. So there are, even though we're talking about free clinics, we also talk about the triage. That's an important step in getting the healthcare you need to be able to go forward. So Mike, I do know those.
Yep. Yeah, sorry, Mike.
You know, I listened to this story through the same perspective that I've listened to some of these other stories, and it's from the funding perspective. That received a lot of emphasis in a couple-minute segment. And so here we are yet again discussing how much funds need to be spent and who needs to spend them. And in this case, do we spend a little now or a lot later? In other words, does the state or some other government organization swoop in to spend what amounts to a small amount of money to have a big impact? Or do we let that money responsibility sit on the shoulders of the people that need the service?
Dana? If I might follow that up as I listened to the story, you know, our country is trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. We don't have enough money. And so it seems to me, as I listened, that we're pushing the burden of not facing that problem down to the least powerful people in the system.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, Jay.
It's, I think when we first met like 5 years ago, one of the interesting things that we talked about were the health outcomes that are measured in Virginia. And I think Roanoke City is something like 112 out of 130. So we're certainly in the lowest 20%. And actually, being a competitive person, that bothers me. I want to live in a community that's at the top, not at the bottom. And apparently we've been in the bottom for like 20 years, if I'm not mistaken. Health outcomes have been down, especially in Northwest, that area. So to Mike's point, we're already in a bad spot, and the money is going down, as that segment said, and the requirements to serve people are going up. So it's an interesting question, going back to what you asked, William. Is this the role of government to get involved? Or are we waiting for the private sector to step up and help Roanoke City get in, at least in the middle of the pack?
Mike?
I'm stimulated by Dana's thoughts and yours as well, Jay. There used to be a series of commercials that were broadcast regularly, and the punchline was, pay me now or pay me later. And the idea was, of course, if you pay me a little now, we can do something preventative, and if you wait, then we'll all be paying a lot more later. So when I hear stories like this, I hear the difference between short-term thinking and long-term thinking. And when I think about our governments, I just so wish they were able to take a longer-term view on so many of these issues. Now, Dana, of course, raised the point about money. Everybody's short of money, and we apparently are more short of money than we've ever been since the beginning of time, I guess. And
even though we're spending more.
We're spending more. But that's exactly why. Thank you, Dana. That is why. Short-term thinking has got us. Thank you. That's my editorial for the moment.
Okay. Wayne.
You know, the cost of medical care is not going to go down. I mean, it's never going to go down. And we can look at it in a number of different ways. We can do away with the Affordable Care Act and put hundreds of thousands of people out there without insurance, and hopefully they'll go to a free clinic or have some other way of getting their medical problems corrected. But we've got to remember that one out of every four of us in this area is over the age of 60, and that's not going down. Our median age in this area is like 44 years. Hmm. And compared to other places, other metropolitan areas, we're 37 years or something like that. Yeah, it's going to continue to be an issue. And we're not getting, well, maybe Jay's getting younger. I don't know. But most of us are not getting younger, and we'll need more, even more care. In the future, that's going to require more money from someplace.
Right. You're listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. You can visit us at roanokecollaborationproject.org on the web, and you can also take our pledge there, which we would hope you would do. You know,
what pledge is that?
Civility pledge, I believe it's called, Dana. So, you know, there is a fractured system here, right? And what I'm hearing is the free clinics are an effort to fill in the fractured system. The state pays for Medicaid. Just the federal government pays for Medicare. The state, localities and philanthropy pay for the free clinics, right? And so there are funding gaps that are created when you have that. You know, people don't really realize, I think I used to talk about this sometimes. Medicare is an insurance program. Medicare is a program that we all pay into through payroll taxes over the course of our working life. And then we have insurance for when we're 65 and older to cover our medical bills. It does not cover everything, though. It's a hospital and physician are covered. A lot of things are not covered, which is why you see the Medigap and all the commercials on television and all that. Medicaid is a welfare program. It's not an insurance program. It is for people that it's an entitlement program. If you meet certain income thresholds, you're entitled to the benefit of Medicaid. We've turned it through the Affordable Care Act, not saying good or bad. We've tried to sort of take a welfare program and turn it into an insurance program. Mm-hmm. And that's created some problems as well. So I also want to point out that I believe the Roanoke Rescue Mission, I know they have the G. Wayne Fralin Medical Clinic. I happen to know that because it's named after my uncle. And the Rescue Mission, of course, does not take state or federal money. And there's a religious reason for that. But that's another piece that can fill in this gap. I just wanted to throw that out there. I'll have the floor.
And again, we mentioned words like entitlement, even though the benefits are helpful to those in need. When we talk about entitlements, I'm just going through the community that I represent, sure, or I live in. Poor, I'm a little child, I grow up, I got free this, free lunch this, I understand, but I don't realize the dynamics of the volunteers of the healthcare position, of physicians, until someone says, hey, David, by the way, there's a cost of everything. And this is the reason why, to help you get to the next level of your understanding of your healthcare, your parents' healthcare, or the community around you. But if we keep, if we keep emphasizing poor, free, entitlement, then little Davey thinks, well, that's all I'm going to do is grow up to be, because that's what I expect when I grow up. I want those handouts.
It's quite an issue. So, but the flip side of that is if the government doesn't provide that entitlement, healthcare, who's going to do it?
Back in the day, the neighbor did it.
Right.
Back in
right.
the day,
yeah.
It was a different environment.
Right.
Well, let me
right.
jump in.
Sure, Cynthia.
From the health system's perspective, Carilion is a not-for-profit, and we have a mission that is part of our core values to serve all the communities that we have presence in. And we have a philosophy of going out to the communities. We're doing our best as a private entity to seek out the areas, geographic areas and neighborhoods that need the care, and put the care there, investing in infrastructure, in staff, in equipment, and in the opportunity to concierge those patients into our larger facilities if they need more complicated treatments. But I think the point being is to your question, how are we going to fill the gap? I think it is the hospital systems and the care providers that are going to have some very transparent conversations with our legislators, our funders, our local legislators as well, municipal leaders, about where the care is needed, and look at the resources that are required to do so.
But I was listening to the story and thinking about what you just said. I would love it if the decision makers who say, hey, we don't have enough money, would sit down with a sick, poor person and tell them face to face, no, we don't have money to help you. Too bad. I think that might change the calculus a little bit.
Wayne?
And I think working, Cynthia, through the hospitals, they could do it as a consortium, maybe move resources around. But we're seeing so many rural hospitals close. And we talk about food deserts. Well, we have medical deserts out there. You may have to travel 40 miles or an hour or so you know, for your care.
True, true. And you know, one of the things I was listening to Dr. Points, from a legislative standpoint, just having been there, they may look at this is a nice-to-have sort of charitable thing. We pay millions and millions and millions of dollars in Medicaid, and that's what we're supposed to be doing. We recognize as a legislator there are gaps, but we want to sort of fill in those gaps. So we're going to give a little bit of money here when we have it. And that may be the up and down. That may be why it's a sort of an up and down. We get $5 million 1 year, $8 million 1 year. It sounds to me like that's what's going on.
And Cynthia, I think Carilion has to accept anyone who comes to the door.
That's right? Correct. Mm-hmm.
And so I was told a story by someone who works for the Allegheny Health District that a young man, or a child, a seven-year-old, had a problem with asthma and had to be rushed off to the ER. That visit was $7,000. And who pays for that? And the hospital picks it up. That can't go on forever. If everyone used the emergency room, I can't imagine what the cost would be.
Well, and remember, just the hospital's picking it up under EMTALA, right, on the emergency medical. If it's a sort of a chronic condition, it creates more problems. And by the way, just because you have Medicaid doesn't mean you can find a provider.
That's correct.
Because many providers limit their take on how many Medicaid patients they will take because they're losing money based on the reimbursement level. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know what Carilion's policy about that is, but I do know some that is a problem.
Well, our area of the state has the highest proportion of Medicaid recipients in the state. So that we know.
Wow.
And I do want to tag on one thing about a government fund source that has come down from the federal government. It is the Rural Health Transformation Grant. It has gone to multiple states. Virginia is a recipient of that. It's a multi-year, multi-million dollar grant that is specifically focused on improving the health access and workforce development in the healthcare industry across the rural areas of Virginia, which is most of Virginia. And the work starts now. The consortium of us have gotten together to plan the initiatives with our community college systems, with our healthcare systems, with all of the medical trade associations to do some targeted things. And I'm really thinking about your comment about the closing of the rural health, of the rural hospitals because of maternal needs and having delivery services, baby delivery services in those areas. That is being addressed, and I have to at least tip a hat to a federal grant that's coming down.
Yeah, Mike.
You know, I'd like to take a contrary view just for a moment. I mean, after all, this is the Roanoke Collaboration Project. We try to take different points of view and demonstrate how to discuss those in a collegial way. So, you know, we're in the United States. Rugged individualism has ruled the day here. So many of our politicians and our decision makers still believe that's a national value that needs to be supported. All right. Well, if you follow that line of thinking, then we work ourselves down to the people who need assistance, maybe medical, maybe food. In this case, we're talking medical. And so the question comes up, why should we help them? If they were just better, more capable, harder working individuals, then they should be able to take care of themselves. And if we make the mistake of helping them, then we're enabling another generation of people to be a burden on society. So there's a contrary view here.
No, and I'm not sure how contrary it is, because I heard Dr. Point say, if everything's free, everything's entitlement, and you feel like everything's being given to you, then you must necessarily need it. You must necessarily be less than. Right? Yeah, Mike.
So I'm a decision maker for the day. Somehow I woke up in the role of being able to make decisions about these important views. So now I've got to trade off what to do. What to do with these limited resources that Dana pointed out. What to do. And again, if I'm in charge, I'm going to try and take the long-term view, the greater good for the long term. If I take that view, what's my metric? What is the outcome I'm looking for to convince me that I'm successful or unsuccessful? In this discussion, what is the outcome-based performance metric that we can look at? Any ideas?
Well, there is the healthcare outcomes. If you just Google online, healthcare outcomes in Virginia, and there's a list of all the communities across Virginia, and we are at the bottom of that list.
That's an interesting detail, but I'm interested in the impact on society. I'm interested in the greater impact.
Well, and there could be a disconnect here. Just listen to y'all go back and forth. Of course, the time horizon of an elected official is usually about 2 years, because that's when Congress has to be reelected or a House member has to be reelected. So you're right. There, long-term planning, when you've got short-term feedback, can be an issue. Dana?
Well, I don't have a good answer to what you're saying, but in terms of how people think about it, why should we help? We'll just make people lazy. And that goes back to the fundamental way that we understand who people are. And some people think that folks are just born lazy, and other people know that people really want to work. They really want to grow. They really want to learn. If you think people are fundamentally lazy, that's going to guide your decision-making on this. If you recognize that humans are more talented than that, you might make a different decision.
Okay. And of course, within that, we're all individuals, so there's a continuum. Yeah, some people are lazy, but that don't mean you brand everybody that way, right?
Well, you might want to figure out how they got that way.
Well, that could be, right, yeah.
Catherine. And the other train of thought I have is that, you know, all of us are just one catastrophe away from being maybe that person that needs those services. And so my long-term view is the fact that I have no guarantee. I have great health now. I'm excited about that part. But as your family comes together, you may have history of different things happening. And I think that's the part you have to look at. What do we do to keep our society healthy, number one? And the other part of that is go back to little Davy here, that we, you know, that we are looking at what we've seen. And, you know, if our family has experienced something that they could do that's preventive, those are the conversations we need to have. And I think it went a long time before I started hearing how important it was for dentistry. If you don't have a lot of things going on with your, you know, taking care of your teeth and things like that, that impacts so many other parts of your body and other things that are going on with you. So it's, again, it's sort of like society. If you don't take care of that thing that's aching, we need to make sure that we can address it so that we can move forward. But again, we're all one step off probably from something.
Well, and dentistry is a good point, but you're right. And what I hear you saying, Catherine, is the safety net piece is important, that we all need a safety net. And I think sometimes people would say the safety net has turned into a permanent situation.
Right.
Yeah, Mike.
Just a little more with the contrary view. So here we are in a difficult economic time for so many people. And now you want me as a taxpayer or a responsible citizen to start bailing out even more people, take more money out of my pocket. Why am I going to do that? Haven't I already filled my civic responsibility now?
That's certainly a view, Joyce.
So you raise a lot of good points, Mike and Catherine, everybody. I think it has to be an all of the above kind of approach. You know, obviously one thing doesn't do the trick, another doesn't do the trick, and it can't be on just one entity or, you know, whether it's hospital or other care systems, and not just on individuals when they do get that, you know, catastrophic whatever and need some help. We don't have time to get into all of that, but, you know, it has to be everyone pulling together and our systems pulling together.
Well, that's going to have to be the end of it. We need to wrap up here. Thank you for listening to the Roanoke Collaboration Project radio show, where we discuss a Radio IQ news story on Radio Melrose. Please visit our website at roanokecollaboration.org.